trying to hate myself unless I have a really good exit strategy, and then I'm a little more okay. I'll get her.
I mean, chapter nine, where are we supposed to be? You know, the reason
you don't see the value of your of their names is because none of them are your relatives.
That's true.
If they were your kinfolk. But you know what the lesson of the names is in the book of Nehemiah.
No, do not.
You clearly did not communicate this when you had the class. The lesson of the names is that God knows your name.
That's the whole lesson.
Yeah, that's
well, I'm cool with that.
Yeah, there you go. Man, we've gotten like two out of three things fixed tonight. What's the other bomb you're going to drop on me?
Thank you.
What?
He covered it.
They're saying that was your class. Well, you mentioned it in your class, too.
Oh, no. I just dealt with the walls, man. This is what you do to interns, throw them under the bus. And that camera is on. We're in chapter 9 tonight. And I want you to work really hard to help me make this relevant for Mark this evening. Let's pray together. It's a blessing to be with your people tonight, Father, and we're honored to be in your presence. And like the people of this book, to have an opportunity to open your book and consider the lessons you would teach us through this great leader. May the revival we consider tonight inspire revival in our own hearts. In Jesus' name, amen. I wanted to start tonight by inviting you to look on the board at the chronology that I put up there. This is one of those segments in the Bible where I would invite you to ignore the chapter divisions for 8, 9, and 10. They all go together, and I think it's not going to make much sense, even though we're doing them over three classes, unless you can sort of separate that out. And so what I did is tried to break this out in a way that might help you put all of that together. We're talking about events that happen over the course of 1 month, right? A couple of times in the text it references the seventh month. That's when all of this is going on. So after the wall is completed, the beginning of the next month, all of this starts happening. Three feast days in that month. The month opens on the 1st with the Feast of Tabernacles. On the 10th, there is the Great Day of Atonement. And then the week of the 15th through the 21st is the Feast of Tabernacles. Those were regular observances of God's people. It's just on this occasion, this particular month, you also have the evidence of this revival going on in Israel. And that's what we said chapters 8, 9, and 10 are all about. All of those chapters are telling the same fundamental story. And I would just back you up a little bit and remind you of what we talked about in chapter 8. Remember, on the first of the month, chapter 8 and verse 1 tells us about that assembly. Do y'all remember that? All the people came together, everybody who could understand, and they have a gathering where Ezra is invited to come and read the law. I would not be dogmatic about this, but I suspect that probably happened on the day of the Feast of the Trumpets, that's what they did on that first day during that celebration, is they had this reading of the law. Because remember, what was their reaction when the law is read for them in chapter 8? You can peek if you don't remember.
They cried.
Yes, they were grieving because
they hadn't been keeping the law.
Yeah, I mean, the law had been lost to them, and now the law is being read, and they're hearing what God's will is. And though I think they suspected they had some issues, They didn't know how big and deep the issues were, and so it was profoundly shocking to them, and there's a lot of grief. And remember, Nehemiah and the other leaders discouraged them from grieving, said this is supposed to be a celebration, right? Not supposed to be grieving. And I think there's a reason for that we'll get to a little bit later. Then remember, on the second day, if you look at chapter 8 and verse 13, on the second day, which I'm assuming is the next day in this seventh month, there's a smaller assembly of leadership to again read the law. And it was while they were reading the law, they discovered something. Do y'all remember this from last week?
They hadn't been preparing for the booths.
Yes. Yes, the Feast of Tabernacles required that they camp for the week and live in these little shelters. And they hadn't been doing that. The shelter part evidently had been neglected. So hence the line up here to the 15th to the 21st, when they observed the Feast of Tabernacles, they grabbed this teaching from back here on the 2nd, and they put it into place. And so they go out and they get branches and they construct the booths and they live in them during the Feast of Tabernacles. So lots and lots and lots have been going on, right? And there isn't anything said in the text about the Day of Atonement. We just know based on the schedule that that would have been right there in the middle of all that, okay? So does that make that a little more clear? You see where we are, kind of how that flows? And that's really only chapter 8. Chapter 8 brings us all the way up to here, okay? So take a peek down at chapter 9. Because where are we, look at verse 1, where are we when chapter 9 opens on the calendar? So it's the 24th of the month. We're 2-ish, 3-ish days after the end of the Feast of Tabernacles. And there is another assembly. And to the best of my knowledge, that wasn't one of these prescribed feast days, like Tabernacles, Atonement, and Trumpets. This seems to be a special day that they have chosen to have another gathering. So now this is the third gathering that we've read about in this section of the book. And the best that I can figure is that the grief back here that they were told, hold off on that, I think what's happening is now they're going to express that over here. There's a day now that's been appointed so that they can kind of vent their sorrow over what they have done. And the reason I conclude that is because that is what happens in 9 and 10. They are really, really dealing with their sin. So that's what's going to be coming for us in chapters 9 and 10. The gap between chapter 9 and 10 is terrible because they're really, that chapter break just interrupts really important stuff. So actually what would be useful in your reading is if you would go back and read those three chapters as a unit when you do your reading. Especially read chapter 9 and 10 as a unit. And so you get a whole picture of what's going on. So let me pause and say, you have a question about that? Yes.
Do you have any idea when they stopped celebrating these feasts? Since they were begun during the wilderness wanderings, when did they stop doing these things? Now they're finding, oh, look what we should have been doing.
No, I don't think they ever stopped observing the Feast of Tabernacles. I just think they left out the camping, which makes sense to me. Because as I said last week, if I was going to leave off part of the feast, it would be the camping part.
You think they were celebrating even during the captivity?
That's a good question, Mark. I don't know the answer to that. There would be, depending, some of the feasts required sacrifices and things, and they would have had to have done that at the temple, which didn't exist. So as far as did they acknowledge the other days, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Perhaps some of them they did that didn't require the sacrifice part. Anybody else?
Who's recounting who's speaking and recounting the history?
Now, are you asking who wrote the book?
No, I don't know. I mean, it gives a list of people that are there, that are standing, but obviously someone is is telling the history of the of their nation.
In chapter 9?
Yeah.
Yes, yes, the Levites are recounting
the history.
Yes, the Levites are the one that, and we'll get to that in just one second. Everybody see how the flow goes, though? You see how the events unfold over the course of this month? So appreciate that you're talking about a really, really brief of time. This brief period of time, this comes right off the finishing of the wall and right into the this inspired revival that they're having, and all of that kind of squishes together in a relatively short period of time. So I do, Mark brought up chapter 9. That's where I want us to work tonight. And so what I'd like you to do for me is to take a peek at the first three verses, and I'm going to ask you the question, what do you see here? And I'm really trying, I think the first three verses give a summary of the day, and then he goes on and he does something else. So help me summarize the day. Read down those three verses, and then let's talk about what's going on. What I'm looking for is what they did on this day. What are the activities of the day? What do you see?
Well, they assembled.
Okay, let's just start with that. 9 in verse 1 says there is an assembly, right? So we've had one here, and we've had one here, we've had one here, bearing in mind that there would have been other assemblies required, like with the Day of Atonement and so forth. They're getting together a whole lot during this period. Okay, thank you.
Is it significant that they separated themselves from
God? Is it?
I mean, I would say yes, but...
They separated themselves from who? Foreigners.
It's the imperial mourning.
Hold that thought. So let me grab that one next. Talk to me about separating from foreigners.
Well, they were never more married to foreigners.
Well, one possibility is that this references the people that some had intermarried with, the outsiders that some of them have intermarried with. They've already had evidence of that problem. Remember in chapter 6 when the wall is completed, we find out that some of the ruling class had intermarried with Tobiah and were actually sharing intelligence back and forth with them. And then that's going to become a problem that's going to be explored more later in the record. But maybe what that means is when they had this assembly, guys married to outsiders did not bring their foreign wives to this gathering. Maybe that's a possibility. The only possibility I thought about was maybe they just shut this off from the neighbors out there who might have done commerce and hanging around. This is just for our people. I'll kind of leave it to you to decide what you think about that. But yes, I think the separation from the foreigners. Let me ask the question to you. Why is that a big deal? Sorry?
Purity.
Certainly it's about purity. But why for this would they make it a point and there be a record of the fact that they said no outsiders in this?
Well, they're dealing with their own sin before God, and the foreigners don't have anything to do with that.
They're dealing with their sin before God. And if I can tag on to what you said about that, the foreigners are part of the sin. So how awkward is it going to be to have your Philistine wife standing with you there as the law is being read about not taking wives from other nations? Yeah, you see the problem? So There was a separation that took place on that day. Tell me what else you see.
They read some more from the book of the law.
How many times have we encountered that during this period?
At least like three, right?
Yeah, because the law is read here at this assembly, and then it's read again here at the smaller assembly. That's where they find out they weren't doing the shelter part right, and now the law is read again here on this day of mourning, and it's evidently read for a long time, like hours.
Fourth of the day.
Y'all really need to feel better about sermon length after reading Nehemiah. Okay? Really, really. I mean, even Jeff's sermon length, you got to feel better about it after reading Nehemiah, guys.
This is like once a year, not once a week.
And y'all get to sit for us when we preach, right?
This was the reading before the sermon.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me the significance. Why are we told again and again and again in this short period during this revival period they read from the law of the Lord?
That's their whole basis for the revival, for recognizing where they are.
I made the point in class last week, and I want to reiterate it again, that revival is not simply about being more excited about God. And I think that's typically what we associate with that word, is having more enthusiasm, being more passionate, excited about the work of God. And I wouldn't deny that as being a piece of it. I would just say it's a remote piece. Primarily, revival was about obedience. And you really see that going through here, that this is about us figuring out what we were supposed to be doing all along that we have neglected. That's the basis of true spiritual revival. And again, it shows up here. We are being redundant about this because Nehemiah is redundant about this. Again and again and again, they read the law. Thank you. What else do you see? We're not done. There's still some more there. What else went on this, at this assembly?
Confession.
Twice, confession is mentioned. Did y'all notice that? In verse 2, they confess their sins. And then again in verse 3, for a fourth of the day, they confessed and worshiped. Okay? Makes sense, right? They've been acknowledging sin all along through this process. What else do you see?
I think it's interesting how they even confess the sins of their fathers. They kind of directly connected themselves to that.
It's been a long history of rebellion. We'll say more about that in a minute. Thank you. Anything else you see?
I think it's interesting that they came with fasting, sackcloth, and dirt, which one version says earth on their head. That represents a very humble point. Their mourning, their sad, I guess.
Yeah. These three things together, fasting, sackcloth, dirt. What's the significance?
Humility.
Humility?
Recognition of wrongdoing?
Mourning.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Can I blend that together? And all of that together. These were Jewish symbols of grief, great grief. And I know it looks a little weird to us. I've sort of tried to get a mental image of dumping dirt or ashes on your head. And I think, well, that's kind of weird, but to be truth, I don't like the idea of fasting either, or sackcloth. But have you ever thought about the fact that every culture has its mourning rituals? Yeah? So if any of you watch any of the numerous shows out there about British royalty, right? There's all kinds of shows out there the last recent years about British royalty. And they have mourning customs, right? Like, Anybody know any of them? How do they have to dress?
Black.
Yeah, they have to wear black. And you have to wear black for a period of time, a designated period of time, all the time, because you are in mourning. And so I thought about that when I was looking at this, that these are just their mourning rituals, their grieving rituals. So that's why I call this a day of grief, because they show up ready to grieve. The other thing that's mentioned specifically is that they worshiped. And so that was part of the day, part of the observance too. And that's actually sort of the segue into what is the body of this chapter. Most of chapter 9 is about what? Someone said something and all I heard was, are you back there whispering? Listen, I know I look like I'm very youthful, but I'm deaf, okay?
Well, it's about the revival.
It is, but there's one specific thing in this chapter that sucks all the oxygen out of the room. What are they doing most of the chapter?
It's like the recounting of history, basically.
Yes, but in what form?
First prayer.
Yes, this is a prayer. Look at verse 4. I'm not going to read the names just because I don't want to. There's a platform that's built, and you have the Levites. It says they cried out with a loud voice to the Lord their God. And then verse 5, they begin this prayer. Arise, bless the Lord your God forever and ever. And they begin this prayer that they lift up to God. That is the rest of the chapter, all the way through to the end. 34 verses, in essence, giving us at least a portion of what they prayed. To me, it ends kind of abruptly. I mean, he's doing a great job kind of running through the history, and all of a sudden he just kind of gets to this place in their history where he stops. And I think, well, maybe he didn't. Maybe they just record a portion of the prayer for us. Maybe there was more to it, as is often the case in Scripture. So here's what I'd like you to do. Again, I'm curious about what you see going on here. So I'm going to ask you to read some of this. Pick up at verse 5, at least the latter part of verse 5, and take off for a little while. The verses are short. Maybe even read down to around verse 20. I think if you read down to verse 20, it'll give you a bigger picture of this. And then I'm going to ask you what you see going on in the prayer. Just one second. It's okay. I'll even let you go first. Let Jared get credited for the first answer, because he said, I see history. Do you see that too? How far back?
All the way back to Exodus.
Genesis 12.
Guys, look at verse 6. You alone are the Lord. You made the heavens. Where are we?
Genesis 1.
Yeah, Jeff would be so proud. By the way, what are we made to think about when we're taken back to God's work as creator? What does that tell us about God? Because I think there's a reason he starts there. I think there's a reason the Bible often starts where God is the creator.
He has all authority.
It's an authority thing. And I just think that is super, super important. I think so often when we go to Genesis, we see cool creation story, 7 days, all that kind of stuff. And that's there, don't misunderstand. But what's underlying all of that, and one of the reasons that there is to say, God made you and everything else. And as his creation, there is this innate relationship that exists. He's in charge. He runs the show. And we bow the knee. And I think that's one of the reasons that the Levites go all the way back there, is to remind them where all this other stuff is going to be rooted. In God's role as creator, in our responsibility to submit to him. Go down to verse 7. He picks up with who?
Abraham,
right? So there's the great patriarch of the family. And in verse 8.
The promise.
Sorry?
The promise.
Yeah, he makes, here's a big word. And I think this word is all the way through it. He doesn't describe the promise. He says what?
Covenant.
God made a covenant with Abraham. And don't minimize that either. So we have authority and we have covenant. That
okay, so I didn't catch that this was a prayer. I thought this was a recounting to the people so they understood their history. God knows all this. What are they praying to God for this for? I mean, I get frustrated when somebody gets up and tells God how great he is. Man, hey, he knows. Take care of us. God will take care of himself. Another story. But this is a teaching reminding the people where they are. The reason for the revival. Well, is this a prayer to God?
Verse 4, and they cried out with a loud voice to the Lord their God. Hang with me a little further and let me see if I can sell you.
Or the end of verse 5.
Yes.
Or it seems like every verse, you. He's talking to you. Who's you? You did this.
We're going to hang with me. We're going to see that. And you're right. He's walking through here rehearsing what God has done. So, creator, choosing Abraham, covenant. And then we get to 9, and we're in Egypt, right? Red Sea, he delivers them from that. Verse 11, divided the sea. Verse 12, led them out. Verse 13, down to Mount Sinai, where the creator does what? He gives them the law. Which, by the way, what's he making with them in Exodus 19? Yeah, it doesn't say it. But that's what it is when he gives the law. In fact, in Exodus 19, 3 through 6, God says, if you will walk in my ways, you will be my people. What is that? Covenant. He makes a covenant with them at Mount Sinai. And so we keep going. He feeds them with bread out of heaven, verse 15, brings water from the rock, and then he brings them to the border of the promised land and says, go up and take it. And so up to this point, it's been all about God. Do you see that? And what he has done. And that's, you're correct in what he says there about you have done this, right? Then there is a break between 15 and 16. And the prayer takes a turn. Verse 15 opens with, you provided, you brought, you told. Then what does 16 do?
Bye.
And what does Randy tell you to do?
Watch the butt.
Watch for the butt. Watch for the butt. I want to be careful about the way you say that. But they, right? Now who are we talking about? Yeah, their forefathers. What did they do? Well, they acted arrogantly, they wouldn't listen, and specifically, look at verse 17. What's he talking about when they say they acted arrogantly and they wouldn't listen?
They didn't live up to the covenant.
Too broad. There's something specific going on. When they go up to the border of the promised land for the first time,
they wanted to go back to Egypt.
They wouldn't go. And so notice he says, they appointed a leader to return them to slavery in Egypt, right? Isn't it interesting? Just think about how this whole thing playing out here is a really a story of their whole history. God offers them the promised land, and they keep choosing slavery, which is their cycle over and over and over again, right? And yet, even wrapped up inside of that, notice the middle of verse 17. In the middle of their rebellion, he says, but you, remember, we're watching for the but you are a God of forgiveness, gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness, and you did not forsake them. So you have the history, but not just random history, right? You have episodes that show how God has been good, and episodes that show their response to God. So, history. What else do we have?
Praise.
Praise? Where do you see that?
All through it. They're naming all these things in this prayer, praising God for having given or done or whatever.
Praise for God for what he's done for them. Yeah. What else do you see? Thank you.
Two halves of the covenant, and which ones are good and which ones are failing.
Yeah, it's the whole layout of this is covenant related, because what it's saying is God honored the contract and we didn't, right? So the other thing that I see when I go through here is I see a contrast that's related to this covenant that God has made with them. On the one hand, God has been more than good and generous to them, honored him to his end of it, and they have just been more than wicked and rebellious, right? Over and over and over again, they weren't covenant keeping. What else do you see?
Kind of focus mostly on one specific aspect of the covenant, which is the land, which makes a lot of sense because that's where they are again. They're finally back.
I hadn't thought about that, but the land is kind of working all the way through here, right? Of the three promises, the land is what is mentioned early on. God promised to give you this land. And then they wouldn't go into the land, and then later God brought them into the land, and then at the end they talk about the land. Thank you for that. What else do you see?
He gave them the law.
More about that, right? Over and over again, this segment talks about the law. You going to keep the law or not keep the law? Thank you. Let me invite you to think about a couple more things before I run out of time. In my notes, I wrote down the word patience. Do you see that? How is patience exhibited in this segment?
God's unbelievable.
Over and over and over again, 9:17, when they refused to go up and take the land, he did not forsake them. And then what you have, I think that if you pick up around verse 20 and go down to about verse 25, no, I'm sorry, go to verse 26 and then run down to, I don't know, 29 or so, I think that's the judge period, right? But they became disobedient and rebelled against you and cast, here it is, Don, cast your law behind their backs. Isn't that a vivid way of describing them? And killed your prophets who admonished them so that they might return to you. Therefore, you delivered them into the hand of their oppressors who oppressed them. But when they cried to you in your time of distress, you heard from heaven, and according to your great compassion, you gave them deliverers. That sounds like the period of the judges. And then verse 28, but as soon as they had rest, what did they do? And they went right back to the evil, right? So that's that cycle of the judges over and over and over again. And what I think you see there is the patience of God. In fact, in verse 30, the Levites say in the prayer, you did this for many years. You just bought us back, delivered us over and over and over again. You're a gracious and compassionate God. The other thing that I saw here that I thought was really important, I'm going to use the word owning. Do you know what I mean when I say that? I see owning when I read this. Who's owning what in this prayer? Yes, I especially when you get to the end, what is really impressive about this after rehearsing their history is it seems to me that they own up, that they are in a mess and they have caused their mess. I'm thinking down, look at verse 33, for example. However, you are just in all that has come upon us, for you have dealt faithfully, but we have acted wickedly. Our kings, our leaders, our priests, our fathers have not kept your law or paid attention to your commandments. So you see it? Everything you've done to us in the form of punishing them. And of course, the most recent punishment would have been what?
Babylon.
Sorry?
Babylon.
Yeah, the Babylonian captivity. They had just come out of that awful mess, and they're still in a mess because of that. And they talk about that. Look at verse 36. Behold, we are slaves today. And as to the land which you gave to our fathers to eat its fruit and its bounty, behold, we are slaves on it. What does that mean?
We're slaves in the place where we should own.
Yeah, we don't even really own this. We're paying tribute to the king back there. We're actually serving someone else, right? Verse 37, its abundant produce is for the kings whom you have set over us because of our sins. That's a great statement of ownership, isn't it? God subjected them to these foreign powers because we sinned. And so look at verse 38. Now because of all of this, we are making an agreement in writing, and on the sealed document are the names, Mark, there you go, there are the names again. The names of our leaders, our Levites, and our priests. And then verse 10, chapter 10, verse 1. Now on the sealed document were the names of Nehemiah the governor, and there you go. There's your list of names that next Wednesday Andrew will share deep and profound things about. He may not get to the rest of the chapter just for the first 27 verses and talking about the list of names. But do y'all see how 9 and 10 go together? You just can't stop, because this is coming out of the prayer. This is, here's what we're going to do, and they have a plan and they wrote it down. Yes, ma'am, what did you write?
Did Ezra write Nehemiah? Because he came back before, and he's the one he's a scribe. I
am inclined to think that Nehemiah is the author, but on authorship stuff, I'm not one to be dogmatic. I think we probably get more concerned about that than God does. Because if God was really concerned about us getting all these authors straight, there was an easy solution for that.
Ezra was the one that told them to put their wives away, and they said...
And Nehemiah's going to do that too.
Yeah.
Now, that's coming.
He said, we'll do it.
One thing I want to say to you real quick as we get into the bell, because I think it's real easy to look at this history and judge Israel harshly and say, how could they do that? God had been so good to them. How could they throw his law behind their back and rebel after he was being so good? Be careful about judging them harshly. Because I think God has been better to us. And sometimes we are like Israel. And the thing I think to do here is to ponder the goodness of God and consider our own response to his covenant rather than judging these guys for their folly. Sometimes I fear we share it. Chapter 10 next week, you will not want to miss the impressive work of Andrew on that 27 verses. How'd you like that setup, buddy?
Thank you for participating in today's worship service presented by the Kleinwood Congregation of the Church of Christ. You can listen again to today's service on our website, kleinwood.com.